It is approximately 1:40 p.m. Madam Secretary, let's establish a quorum. Let's call the roll.
Senators Canella?
Here.
Canella here. Leyva? Mitchell?
Here.
Mitchell here. Runner? DeLeon?
Here.
DeLeon here.
Okay, today we're going to be a little shorthanded, but I think we can make through it. We have three individuals here in the Rules Committee. We've established a quorum. Ms. Mitchell, welcome, as well as Mr. Canella. Why don't we go to file item number one, bill referrals. Can I get a motion? We have a motion made by Ms. Mitchell. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Canella?
Aye.
Canella, aye. Leyva? Mitchell?
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Runner? DeLeon?
Aye.
DeLeon, aye.
File item number one passes on a 3-0 vote. Let's go over, skip file item number two. Let's go 3-6. We're going 3-6, if I can get a motion.
So moved.
We have a motion made by Ms. Mitchell. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Canella?
Aye.
Canella, aye. Leyva? Mitchell?
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Runner? DeLeon?
Aye.
DeLeon, aye.
File items number 3-6 pass on a 3-0 vote. Let's go to the appointees that are required to appear today. Appointments by the governor, if we can have Ms. Assemblywoman Conway, as well as Ms. Perry, please. Assemblywoman Conway and Ms. Perry, if you could be so kind enough to introduce yourselves, a brief statement, and if there's anyone in the audience that you'd like to present, loved ones, friends, frenemies, whoever they may be, please do so.
Oh, if we're going alphabetical, I guess that means I'm first.
Whatever you'd like, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem, I appreciate it. I just appreciate this opportunity to be here today and to have an opportunity to be appointed to serve on the Community College Board of Governors as a recovering legislator, as some people have described me. Doesn't mean I'm not interested in a comeback, I will say for the record, but one of the things I've enjoyed through this opportunity is to see the legislation passed in this great house and how it's implemented on the other side. So serving on the Board of Governors for me is very interesting as I watch pieces of legislation then put into action for community colleges. I feel that education is a great equalizer. Student success is of utmost importance to me, and I'm very pleased to have this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Assemblywoman Conway. Ms. Perry.
Thank you. I feel privileged to be here and to be potentially serving on the Board of Governors for the Community Colleges. My reasons for being here are, one is personal. My husband and I adopted two girls from foster care, and our oldest started at Santa Monica Community College and went on to UC Davis, the first person in her biological family to go to college, and I credit the Community College for making that possible for her and creating an environment where she could go on to succeed. Professionally, I also work with youth in foster care, and the greatest determinant of a youth going into foster care is poverty. And I think the community colleges and the opportunities they're now providing for 14,000 youth who've been in care to move those kids into a vocation or onto a four-year education are absolutely crucial. And I hope to work to increase those opportunities. I'm incredibly impressed what the community colleges have done to date. And I want to work with my colleagues to further those programs that exist because they're making a big difference for those youth. And then in the short time that I've been serving, I've seen the vital role that the community colleges play in potentially play. And as a Californian, I see those 1 million middle school jobs, and I can't think of a better venue to fill those jobs than the community colleges and the CTE and other programs that they're providing. So I'm honored to be able to work in all those capacities.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Perry, why don't we just jump right into it, and then we'll go to questions and answers and as well as commentaries. We're a little short today with a couple of members who are just slightly under the weather today, but we'll do well with Ms. Mitchell and Mr. Canella. Let me start off on the issue of judgment and sage or prudent decision making. I will say, reading the bios, in particular with you, Ms. Perry, I am a little concerned with judgment issues. given that you're married to Andy Spott, right?
So yes.
I'm a little concerned about that decision-making right there.
I've had almost 24 years to consider the wisdom of that judgment, and the jury's still out. But I'm happy to come back to you and address that first.
Okay. This is a live stream, so I'm making an assumption that he's somewhere in Los Angeles watching this and hearing this as we speak right there. But what I'll do is I'll come back around. Let me go to the members right now. We'll start with Ms. Mitchell.
This will probably surprise you and Mr. Cannella, Mr. Pro Tem. I have no questions. I support and will look forward to make the motion to support both these nominations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That says a lot.
In the spirit of brevity, I would have to say I've actually interviewed both of these applicants or appointees, and I think they'd be fine appointees to the board. So. No question.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Cannella. Well, I will dive in, and I'll take up all the time that they would have used. But just a couple larger issues, because the community colleges, in my estimation, and I know you're in the middle of selecting a new chancellor, which I, in my opinion, is sort of the chief lobbyist, if you will, for the community college. That's my opinion, is what it does, you know, because the centralized power of your system is such that as a chancellor of either community college district like Los Angeles or San Diego, or just a one community college like San Francisco and elsewhere throughout the state, the power and the money is there with budgets to effectuate real change. So I want to talk to you about the economy and how it relates to the role of the Board of Governors as Community College Board of Governors. We have the UC system, we have the Cal State system, and we have the Community College system. And I think there has been, no doubt, a great bias towards the UC system, which is unquestionably the greatest public institution, public higher education institution in the country, bar none. We currently occupy the seventh largest GDP on planet Earth. That being said, we know that not every single California resident child is going to be admitted to a UC school, let alone even the flagship schools, Cal, UCLA, and UCSD. It is my estimation, and I don't know if folks share this, but just my own opinion, that the community colleges will actually play perhaps an even greater role, contingent on the vision, or perhaps lack thereof, of either the next chancellor or the current chancellors that you have, or even your own community college staff, quite frankly, here in Sacramento, with regards to green technologies, energy efficiency, dealing with climate change, jobs that can be created in California that don't require a BA, an MA, an MS, a PhD, or JD, but just going to community college and getting a solid education, and perhaps we have Senator Marty Block, who has really moved the ball and changed the paradigm where I believe you can become a registered nurse at certain community colleges. And my thinking right now is, especially for students of color, when you see the large gap with Silicon Valley and who the coders are coming from everywhere else but California. So do you have to go to UCLA or UC Berkeley or UCSD or Merced and elsewhere or Davis to become a coder? Or is this something that we can say, hey, perhaps we can get a BA degree or an AA degree that suffices to get into the world of coding as well as green technology? What is your vision and how do you see it? And if you don't share my thoughts or opinions, that's okay. Just be upfront about it. But I'm curious.
Well, I think one of the things, to your point, that has just been done, the Task Force on Workforce and the Economy, looks exactly at that issue. And we're lucky enough that was the recommendations were put forward last fall, 25 of them, looking at exactly that issue. How do you look at what the skills needs are, and then how do you go into the regions and match the courses and the curriculum and the planning so that there's a match between the skills that are needed and the curriculum and the instruction at the community colleges. And that's one of the things the task force is working to do, and I think looks at exactly what you're talking about. If we need coders, I think the community colleges are now in the place where they have the flexibility and they can be facile enough to say, we need to develop a program, a CTE program, whatever it is, that looks at coding and the kind of jobs that are needed to move the economy forward.
Let me just add one thing before Assemblywoman Conaway offers her thoughts. Say we just negotiated, which we believe was a very comprehensive, very handsome, very ambitious film and TV tax credit. So we look at Los Angeles, LA City College, you know, and do our community colleges, you know, training, or do we have programs set up to take advantage of the film and TV tax credits, particularly young students of color at the lowest economic strata, South LA, Crenshaw, East LA, Pacoima, and elsewhere, take advantage? You know, if not, is this something that we should be talking about? Kern County is an energy county. Kern County is either fossil fuels or the largest wind installation, you know, in the country. Texas, you know, generates more electricity from wind, but the largest, you know, installation is actually Tehachapi in your neck of the woods, you know. And I know the economy has been very volatile in Kern County. So in Kern County, do we wait for the gyrations of a global market with regards to extraction and whether the extraction is domestic in Kern County or elsewhere globally? Or do we say in Bakersfield Community College District, you know, do we start preparing and sending us as policymakers, send the market signals for capital investments and say, hey, manufacturing and elsewhere with green technologies, energy efficiency, sun, using the power of the sun through solar and wind, do we establish Bakersfield Community College as the premier community college in the nation when it comes to generation of wind power?
Well, I think that community colleges are uniquely positioned. You know, there's such a blend to start with, funded as like K through 14, but yet considered part of the higher education system. But I think they are uniquely positioned to take this challenge of the future, and how do we do that? So each community college, although it's part of a big system, it has its own culture, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, they have their own president, each campus, and as I've discovered in this past year, as you make campus visits and see what's important to each area, exactly as you said, how do they, the film industry in the Los Angeles area and energy production in the Central Valley, how does each campus develop that culture? And can we find the leadership as we go through our search to get our message out? Sometimes I think it's, I used to say that about myself. I don't like others to define me. I prefer to define myself. And I think at this juncture for community colleges, we have an opportunity to define ourselves and to make people, sure people understand exactly what community colleges do and how they drive the economy in many ways and how they can offer so much to California as an economic driver, but also that equalizer, as I said, to connect students with the jobs that can change not only their future, because I believe when you change students' future, you change California's future.
No, absolutely. I think there's a lot of members as well as staff members inside this building where I think community colleges have played a key vital role in their lives. And I think how I know some of your, you can correct me, the titles of the chancellors of each campus or presidents?
Presidents.
Presidents. The presidents of the campuses, contingent on their vision or lack thereof, you know, will be how, you know, they transform their campus. Like you said, each campus has a different culture, different dynamics, different socioeconomics. I know Santa Monica Community College have focused just on this transfer pipeline. You know, many of them are students from all over the world and all over the country, as opposed to a lot of organic students, you know, geographically, actually from the Los Angeles area. But, you know, no criticism. They've done a wonderful job. But when you break into the data and you really look at it, you know, it doesn't give us a really full picture, you know, when we know folks from all over the world or focus on, I'm going to do my couple years, establish my residency, and get into UCLA or elsewhere. You know, so I do believe strongly that the community college district system will play just an invaluable role, perhaps even more so than the UC or Cal State University system. And I know that just recently, with your chancellor and Chancellor Janet Napolitano and I should say President Napolitano and Chancellor Tim White, you guys did something that was quite innovative and groundbreaking. You actually picked up the phones and talked to each other, which was an incredible siloed approach that we've had with higher education. And it's meant as a constructive criticism because it is one, you know, to actually pick up the phone and talk with each other was quite innovative but much needed. And I think that the Board of Governors and the culture that you bring to both the staff as the institution, as well as whoever your new chancellor is going to be, is really important if we're going to recalibrate a new economy of tomorrow. The status quo is simply not good enough for what we need to be, or what we need to be in the near future. That being said, obviously, we need to do our job as well, too, as legislators. With that, we're going to go to those who are supporters of Assemblywoman Conway and Ms. Perry, those who are supporters, those who are in opposition. Do not fault Ms. Perry because of Andy Spahn. There was some movie or film that you did not like. And seeing that, okay, anyone who's agnostic, I'm seeing that. So with that, I think we have a motion that's going to be made.
Yes, sir. I'm moving on.
We have a motion made by Ms. Mitchell. And let me say this to Ms. Conaway, as a former member of the State Assembly, the former Republican leader of the Assembly Republicans. I have a lot of respect and admiration for your leadership. Your talents and skills go beyond your expiration date as a legislator. I believe in the work of legislators. I know sometimes when you have legislators, either senators or assembly members who are appointed to certain commissions, it comes with a sense of controversy sometimes, even with the media, which I find a little odd given the fact that if you represented 1 million constituents and you had the skill set to negotiate complex and arcane budget matters and policy matters, once you're termed out, I don't think that talent skill set just expired with it altogether. You know, the fact that you bring a skill set and an insight that no one has is unique. You know, so I thank you very much for your continued service.
Thank you.
So we have a motion made by Ms. Mitchell. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Cannella?
Aye.
Cannella, aye. Leyva? Mitchell?
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Runner, De Leon?
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Ms. Perry, Assemblywoman Conway, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, colleagues, we're going to move on to the Fair Employment and Housing Council. That is Mr. Michael Iglesias, or Michael, or Miguel. Bienvenido. Welcome.
Gracias.
If there's anyone that you'd like to introduce, please do so, and then make hear your statement, and then we'll go to Q&A.
Great. Good afternoon, senators. Thank you very much for being here. I'm here with my wife, Anne Grassani.
Anne Grassani. Welcome.
And our children, Lucia and Greg, are both away at college, so they can't be here.
Congratulations.
But I'm a professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and I'm very happy to be here today. I'm very honored to be appointed by the governor to the council, and very excited to serve the people of California in this role. I feel that this is a very important area of public policy. In my view, every person really needs a job, and they need a house, a home. Both for their individual development, for their development as a family, and for their communities to develop. So for me, the mission of the department and of the council to provide a fair opportunity for everyone to get a job and to have a home is really a valuable thing and something I feel a lot of passion about. And it's equally incumbent on the council, if we're making regulations, to make sure that those regulations are the least burdensome possible on the regulated communities. So that's something we have to balance and keep in mind always. I believe I have some expertise and some good experience to bring to the council. And since my wife and I are now empty nesters, I have a little bit more time to give to public service. So I'm very happy to be here, and I look forward to answering any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll go straight into questions, answers, commentaries. Ms. Mitchell.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for the time we spent together today. As I share with you, I know your colleague on the council, Ms. Schur, we both worked together for the Weston Center on Law and Poverty in a past life. And I'm hopeful and really optimistic about the work you're both doing as you two constitute the Housing Regulations Subcommittee and the critical, important work that you're going to oversee there. I was pleased to see, and have to say it's very characteristic of my issue with Ms. Schur, I wasn't surprised about all kind of the background data that you all requested from the department in terms of legislative history, just clearly preparing yourselves for the task ahead. Could you talk to us a little bit about the status of the regulatory process, the regulation that you're drafting for the subcommittee? Mm-hmm. And do you have a sense of a timeline, when you think they'll be before the full council and ultimately final completion date? And I'm curious just because I'm clear about how critical that work will be to continue to drive the work of the department as a whole.
Okay, great, thank you. So the council has two housing subcommittees. The first housing subcommittee is working on the bulk of the housing regulations, and they put out in our last meeting a sort of a working draft for the purposes of sort of a workshop. They're coming back to our next council meeting, which is April 7th, with a particular set of regulations on criminal background history in employment decisions. And then they're also coming back on sexual harassment in housing decisions. Then they're coming back with a working draft again for another piece of that. Our housing subcommittee, which is Dara and I, we've been tasked with four different topics. How criminal information is used in housing decisions, credit histories, how Fair Housing Act applies to land use decisions, and disparate impact. I'm working currently on the criminal background part, and I expect to, with Dara, be proposing to the council probably in the summer a set of proposed regulations to start that piece. We haven't worked out exactly a timeline for the rest, but she is, I think it's public knowledge, going on kind of a lesser schedule for her work, her job. So she's going to have more time available too. So I would suspect that by the end of the year, we would have at least half of our agenda going forward, if not all of it, in the beginning of the rulemaking process.
And beyond that work, what's your vision for your term? What do you hope to accomplish while serving in this capacity as a still relatively new appointee?
Yeah, thank you. I think my major contribution will be to the housing regulations, because giving input on the housing regulations that the Housing Subcommittee number one proposes as well, because as you know, under the Bagley-Keene Act, we can, in a seven-person council, we can only have two people in each subcommittee, and we only get what the work of the other subcommittee does in our public hearings. So it moves a little slowly, but I look forward to, and I have prepared and have continued to participate in giving feedback to the other subcommittees' housing regulations. So I think that's going to be my primary work, at least in the next year or so.
I appreciate your opening statement. Sometimes it's the most succinct of statement that just speaks volumes, and the whole notion that people deserve a job and a place to live is so kind of fundamental, I think, to my role as a state legislator and what should be the goals and aspirations of every Californian. So I appreciated that perspective and you framing your role in that context. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Mr. Cannella.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. We had a nice meeting this afternoon, and we went through a whole litany of questions that I was comfortable with your answer. And I just also appreciate your ability to be unbiased when you're thinking about these issues. As an advocate for, you know, affordable housing and your background in general, I think it would be hard for me to separate my professional and lifelong experiences and then all of a sudden become impartial when you're making decisions. And I felt comfortable from our discussion that you're able to do that, and I appreciate that, because although I do believe everybody deserves a house and a job, but they can't come at someone else's expense, right? So it has to work for everyone. And in our discussion on inclusionary housing, I have concerns with inclusionary housing and what that means. However, if it's kind of combined with the housing bonus or fast tracking, I think that's the way to get to the end of what everybody's trying to achieve. And it seems like that's the way that you view things. And I appreciate that, because we may not agree philosophically on a lot of these issues. Mm-hmm. I think we can both agree that it has to be a fair process. It has to be a transparent process. Everybody has to be a part of the process. Mm-hmm. And I was very comfortable with your answers and how you deal with those issues. So thank you very much for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you much, Mr. Cannella. Do we have any folks? We'll go to supporters. Any folks in support? The fact that your wife hasn't raised her hand tells.
I know. I have to talk to her.
That is a clue. Ms. Mitchell is correct. Ms. Mitchell is right. Any detractors? Anyone from Santa Clara University? No Broncos or Gales? Yeah. Okay. Well, my daughter's a gal.
Oh, okay.
But she wanted to be a Don. okay. We have no supporters, no detractors. With that, I'd like to entertain a motion. We have a motion that made by Ms. Mitchell. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Cannella.
Aye.
Cannella, aye. Leyva. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Runner. De Leon.
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Mr. Iglesias, congratulations. You pass on a 3-0 vote.
Thank you very much.
Now, next we'll go to Ms. Deidre Lowe and Jose Razo, Workers' Comp Board. Welcome. I think you've seen the way we're kind of rolling right now. There's anyone, any loved one, friends, you know, that you'd like to introduce, please do so. We'll go into a brief statement, and then we'll go to questions and answers.
Thank you, Chairman. I'd like to introduce my husband, Michael Lowe, who's here this afternoon.
Welcome.
I have had the honor and privilege of serving on the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board for the last 8 years. The work of the board is very important to our workers' compensation system because it is the last administrative word on cases being appealed by either injured workers or employers in the state. Also, the board's work, the board sets binding precedent for the community in the form of on-bank decisions, which is also very important. The work on the board is extremely challenging and interesting, and I have been honored to serve there, and I'm very honored to have been reappointed for a second term, and I'm very much looking forward to serving, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Lowe. Mr. Russell.
Yes, my wife, Laura, is sitting in the audience.
Laura, welcome.
We have two children. We've been married 34 years. My oldest son, Lorenzo, graduated from Santa Clara University with a degree in business. My youngest son, Orlando, is a third-year student at UC Davis, and he plays baseball. And so, again, their schedules did not permit they were here. My parents are of Mexican descent. The life of our family mirrors very much the story told by Victor Villaseñor in his book, Reign of Gold. I was the first in my parents' family, to graduate from college. I attended Stanford University, graduated from Stanford. I graduated from the University of San Diego Law. My first job was in the Legal Service Corporation. I practiced for 34 years as an applicant's attorney and as a defense counsel. During my years in private practice, I volunteered in legal and community activities, served on school boards and in my children's school activities. I believe I bring a balanced perspective from my years of legal and personal experience. I have a professionalism, a sense of humor, respect of all points of view, and try to find solutions. I've been serving on the board now since June of 2015. Much of what Ms. Lowe has spoken, it is a collaborative effort. It's an interesting place where we really sit back and attempt to do each case the best possible view and consideration, and to treat all cases unbiased and in a jurist manner. Thank you.
Thank you much, Mr. Russell. That humor really comes through. Let's go to questions and answers. We'll go with Ms. Mitchell, please.
Mr. Pro Tem, I assume that you're going to ask a series of questions on the implementation of your bill, SB 863. Okay, perfect. So then,
please feel free.
You got that. Thank you. I just wanted to check before I skipped that section. So thank you both for your willingness to serve. Appreciate it. And appreciate the time we spent together the other day. I would just really reiterate the question that I posed to you all to allow you to get your comments on record. And basically, I shared that in past confirmation hearings for members for this board, the question has often come up about the backlog of appeals due to their, quote, higher complexity. And I shared that from our perspective as electeds, these are the cases we get the calls on from our constituents. And our perspective is that a backlog equals delay in kind of resolution and potential payment of benefits. And I appreciate the challenge you face operationally in terms of more complex cases. But if you could talk a little bit about what your experience has been, is there a backlog, and what you're doing to try to kind of work through those more complex cases to reduce kind of resolution time for Californians.
We just had a discussion with that a little earlier with Senator Cannella, and as I explained, our board actually has a 60-day limit for the petitions, the majority of the petitions which come in, which are petitions for reconsideration. And they're denied by operation of law if they're not acted upon in that period of time. So we are very focused on getting, we get about 90% of our decisions out within that 60-day period. The remainder of the cases, in order to prevent them from being denied by operation of law, we grant them for study. And there are a variety of reasons for that, anywhere from under consideration for one of our on-banks dealing with one of the central issues that's facing the workers' compensation community at the time, to a very difficult and complicated case that needs a little extra time for deliberation. We're always trying to balance that balance of getting the case out as quickly as possible, but also making the quote, the right decision, the best possible decision under the circumstances. We also have mechanisms in our office to even identify cases that where benefits are at issue, temporary disability or some medical treatment, and we try to give those priority as well so that they don't lag.
Yeah, every case that comes to the board is, there are panels of three commissioners, and there's in-bank decisions, which would be with the entire board, but every case is individually reviewed by a independent review of a panel member, and it would go to each panel. So it's not perfunctory where you deny cases just automatically. It really, every case is given its due consideration, and sometimes it'll require, as you said, further study. But I think if the board really stays within that time frame of 60 days, and if it goes beyond that, it really is, there is a complexity of issues.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mitchell. Mr. Cannella.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. So we also just recently had a discussion, so it's good to see you two again. But and I was impressed with a lot of your answers. And I'm always honestly, since I've been on rules, I've been impressed with the calibers of the appointee, the caliber of the appointees. I think when you're not part of the system, you think, or I think a lot of folks outside think that these are just kind of crony appointments, and I will say I have not seen any of that. Every person that I've talked to has been very qualified, and you two have been very qualified as well.
Thank you.
But I want to elaborate a little bit on, or just discuss again a little bit about the view that I've seen, or the experiences that I've had, where you see some folks get hurt and they almost retire on workman's comp, and they're really not that hurt. And then I've known lots of folks who are really injured, and they can't get their you know, the compensation that's due to them. And you guys both mentioned, or you two mentioned that that's really, those are outlier cases. But what can we do? I mean, and I'm more concerned about the workers that are truly injured and they can't get that because their whole life has changed, right? It's to no fault of their own, now they can't make their house payments. How can we do a better job at, number one, if people are abusing the system, to go after them and hold them accountable, but more importantly, the folks that are truly injured and it's taking way too long to get through the process. It may be 60 days for once it comes to the board, but there's certainly different levels to get to that point. How can we make that better?
You know, it's in 34 years of practice, as I tell you, Senator, anecdotal cases of both that you see of persons that probably were overcompensated or undercompensated. California doesn't have a perfect system. It's a no-fault system. But I think the benefits that it provides are really required, the medical care. And I really think that's a small percentage.
But even one injured worker, they can't get their compensation.
You're not going to have, clearly, there's going to be cases that go through that situation. But as from my experiences, they have been very, very few cases that I've seen.
Okay. So we can't do anything better?
Oh, we could always do better. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think about that as the board? I mean, I don't know how you have the ability to make it better, but I mean, that should be something that we strive to do as a state, right? As a legislator, I should strive to do better. As commissioners, we should strive to do better. And again, especially for the folks, because I've known, I know it's, you know, outliers, but I'll tell you, I've known a lot of folks who just couldn't get the compensation due to them who's been injured, and I know a lot of folks who have had employees that aren't really, you know, they're hurt and they're getting paid, but they're playing basketball or football. So, I mean, if I know a few of them, then I think there's probably more out there. So I would like your commitments to try to hold those folks accountable and try to expedite the system for the folks that are injured. So.
And of course, that's what we try to do when we look at the cases, because we do see disputes about how much temporary disability is owed, how much permanent disability is owed. That type of thing. So those issues only come in directly to us in terms of deciding the cases and implementing the law, and we don't have to make the hard choices of the policy itself.
Yeah. So. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cannella. Ms. Lowe, Mr. Russell, Senate Bill 863, the largest reforms of workers' comp since Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. I learned a lot about workers' comp, a lot more than I wanted to learn about workers' comp, you know, the complexities, the trough that it is, the inefficiencies, as well as the corruption and everything that goes with workers' comp. It is something like I've never seen before. With 863, what's working, what's not working?
You know, that's a difficult question for us to answer from our perspective, Senator, because we are actually seeing litigated cases, which is, fortunately, as I understand it, a very small percentage of the workers' compensation claims that are made in the state. The vast majority of claims actually never reach a litigated state. And then of the litigated cases that go before a judge for a decision, we are seeing a very small percentage of those that actually get sent up on appeal. So I feel personally I don't have the range of information to, you know, make a determination on exactly what's working and what isn't.
Fair enough. Is it for just lack of information, or you just
exactly, because we're just seeing a very small slice of cases and
percolate up to you.
I'm not in the day-to-day trenches, you know, handling cases or working on either side for an insurance company, or, you know, representing injured workers and seeing what happens more from that perspective.
Could part money take, but could that be indicative of the fact that it is working, that you're seeing
and fewer are coming up on appeal, or is that just not how the process works? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. It could be. I'd have to, you'd have to check on the averages of litigation. And I know we've had more litigation after the passage of 863, obviously, because questions, implementation of a new law always raises new questions, sure, which get litigated, so.
Mr. Russell.
Yeah, I've lived through it being in workers' compensation for 34 years, and the changes in the law in 1989 through 1990 required some further changes in 2003 and 2005 when changes took place. These are, again, really looking back at how the system best operates, I think. And again, in 2013, with the changes in the law, I think a lot of the formularies, a lot of the regulations haven't all been finalized. So it's really premature to say,
still fluid,
is it working yet? Yeah. We're seeing a lot of cases come, but a lot of the issues still are coming to us. And so I think it's a little early to say, where is it? I think it's created some stability in the medical treatment issues, and I think benefits are going up. So I think you have to wait a little bit, and I think there will be some reviews when you look back at what happened in 1989, when you look back in 2003. Is this the nature of the legislation?
What is the size currently right now of the backlog on the liens? The backlog on the liens? Would you know that, Ed?
I saw articles in Work Comp Central, and I don't know. I know that there was Angelotti was decided that really required that liens be processed and filed and the fees be paid between November and December 31st, and there were some exceptions. So there was a rush to file that filing fee. There is revisiting these issues. But I think if you see the articles, that there's a predominantly Southern California, whatever the reason that might be, but I don't know the exact reason. But hopefully this system is in place now. You'll see the results, but I might be too soon.
Okay, thank you. You know, like I said, I learned a lot, more than I expected. And
yes, very.
Show it to my office and actually see protesters galore. And I was like, wait a second, those are my friends. No. It's just like, it's a very complex issue, very much so. But reforms, although not perfect by no stretch of the imagination, really were needed, in a system that was running amok with no accountability or efficiency to it. But we can always look back and make better what we've attempted to reform, what works, what doesn't work. With that, we're gonna go for those who are in support of Ms. Lowe and Mr. Rasson. Those in support, those in opposition. No folks in opposition. With that, why don't we go for a motion, if we have a motion. We have a motion, we have a trifecta from Ms. Mitchell. we have a motion by Ms. Mitchell. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Cannella.
Aye.
Cannella, aye. Leyva. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Runner. DeLeon.
Aye.
DeLeon, aye.
Ms. Lowe, Mr. Russell, congratulations.
Felicidades. Thank you very much.
Okay, colleagues, just one last item before us, before we go into an executive session. I just want to, someone who we know already, but I want to introduce Leonor Ayling. Leonor Ayling is the deputy here for the Rules Committee. She was formerly the director of SOR, the Senate Office of Research. So I want to welcome Leonor to the Rules Committee. With that, we will go into an executive session, which should be very brief.